Welcome to ClassicSinai.com. The class you're about to hear is one of 26 free, all-star Jewish classics available to help you live a more vibrant, meaningful, and fulfilling life.
Good to see you all today. Bright, cheery, chipper faces. Everything's fine and dandy. Wonderful. Greetings. You've been learning Hebrew a little bit, from what I understand. Yeah, tem medabrim ivrit. Yeah, right. Can I just see, just so we know who we're talking to, etc., a show of hands, how many people are familiar with the Hebrew letters, the block letters? Great, great. Okay. And how many people know the script letters? Good. And speaking Hebrew, you have a little bit down already? We'll get along just fine. Right, so, you know, languages, when we talk about language, you know, most languages, they develop, they change, they grow through time, etc. And, you know, if you take out Chaucer, you know, some old English, Middle English, whatever, you open it up and it's like, what is this? It's very hard to understand. You know, go for Beowulf and it's out there, you know, at least in the original, right? You take a look at the English language, you speak to people from England as opposed to people from America, Canada. It's really, in certain ways, becoming different languages. Now, nowadays, with communications, etc., things merge, they meld together, and you end up with a global language. But languages change and grow. Hebrew, as it's spoken here in Israel, is no different. It changes and grows through time. It adapts, so to speak, to the culture going on. You know, if you want to get from here to there, you go out and you get on, and the word in Hebrew is autobus. Now, autobus, I don't think is one of those ancient words that goes back X thousand years. It's just, you know, it's autobus, right? If my wife wants to get somebody to watch the kids while she goes out, she will get a, the word in Hebrew is, well, in Hebrew, it's babysitter, right? It's unbelievable. Hey, if you want to, the thing that holds the wheels onto the back of a car, the back wheels, the thing that holds them on is in Hebrew, a? Back axle. Back axle, right? The thing that holds on the wheels in the front is called a? Well, pretty close. Actually, in Hebrew, it's called a back axle kodmi. The front back axle, right? So it does have its little, yeah, it's unbelievable, huh? You go into the store and you want something to carry papers, you know, those soft leather briefcases. You'll ask the person for a tick. If, however, you want one of those briefcases, click, click, and it opens up and it's got the hard thing. That is called, in Hebrew today, that's called a tick James Bond. And it's shortened to be just called a James Bond. And if you go into a store on Java Street and you'd say, I'd like to see a James Bond, they'll bring out a little briefcase that opens up. And, you know, you customize it how you want. But that's a language that grows and changes. And I'm sure before Ian Fleming, nobody called it a James Bond. On the other hand, what we're dealing with today is called Lashon HaKodesh, which would normally be translated as, let's say, the holy language. What we're going to be talking about is not Hebrew as it's spoken in the streets. What we're going to be dealing with today is Hebrew as it appears in the Bible. Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, in fact, that's one of the explanations why it is called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, is because it's the language through which the prophets spoke. It's the language of the Bible. That alone makes it something special. Kodesh also means separate. That's a literal meaning for the word. You talk about holy. What is holy? You know, it's hard to get a definition for a vague concept like that. But Kodesh, meaning separate, it's a language that's separate and beyond and different than any other language in the world. And as we progress, you'll tell me whether that's going on. If we look in the Bible, the story of Adam and Eve, Adam is shown all the animals. God takes all the animals, walks them past Adam, and it says, Adam named the animals, and what he named them is what they were. Great. What do you call this?
Rover, right? Roof.
That's called Rover. Now, you know, what does that mean, what he named it is what it is? Rover, it could have been Fido, right? You know, it depends on... He called it a Kalev. A Kalev is a dog. What it means when the Torah says that what he named them is what they are, he was able to see the essence of what these things are all about. He was able to look at this creature, figure out exactly where its spiritual root is coming from, and give it a name that would describe the essence of what it is. That's the bottom line. Lashon HaKodesh, if I talk about a chair, right, that word in Hebrew, in English, chair. Now, what does chair mean? Anybody know? Well, that's Hebrew already. That this is a chair. You know, we can talk about how a chair is something that you sit on, something that holds you up, whatever. But the word chair, it's a symbol. It's a auditory symbol that we all agree on, and it means that thing. And if you talk to somebody from Latin America, he doesn't know what a chair is unless he knows English. He'll call it a silla. Great. Great. Fantastic. But that's also a symbol that they all agree on. That's what it means. There's no intrinsic meaning. But kisei, the word in Hebrew, actually describes the essence of what the thing is all about. The Hebrew language describes the actual existence of what the word is. It seems like a wild concept, and as we go on, we'll see a few examples. That's the best way to see it. Yeah?
Just really quick, I'm kind of confused about this. The whole debate began with Israel and why they didn't want to speak the Hebrew language, because they thought it was, because they knew it was only the biblical language, right? Well, if it was spoken by Moses and by everybody as they were traveling from Egypt to Israel, then it's a biblical language, but they spoke it as a language, right? So why is that a debate? Why would that be a debate?
Well, the question is,
in the whole of once they got to the whole of once, well, now in the whole.
The question is, where did the debate come from about whether or not to speak English, speak Hebrew in Israel? The truth is, I have to tell you, I don't know so much about a debate whether or not to speak Hebrew. There are people who speak English. There are people who speak Yiddish. There are people who speak Spanish. I don't know so much about a debate whether or not to use Hebrew. I could imagine some people, in terms of sensitivity, it's a holy tongue, as we're going to be talking about, and to use it in the street may not be called honorable to the language itself. There may be people with that sensitivity, but I'm really not so familiar with a real debate. Okay. Yeah. So the language, where are we?
Essence.
Yeah, the essence of what a thing is. There's a lot of ways we can approach this. We're going to go through a few of them. This particular class is going to be more of an omnibus of ways to look at the Hebrew language. And if nothing else, maybe we'll just walk out seeing that there is something special going on with this language. If you take the word chair and you break it apart, right? Chair, C-H-A-I-R. Great. You could break it apart into C and hair, right? And I don't think that has anything to do with what a chair is. Probably less. On the other hand, if you take the Hebrew words for things and start to break them apart, we can see that they actually can describe a little bit of the essence of what something is. And it's incredible how deep some of this can go. We'll get back to chair because that's another level of looking at things, but we talked about Fido, dog, right? or depending on where you're from, dog, right? It's that, can I say? My wife's from North Carolina, so it's a in Hebrew, it's a kelev. It's easier if I use these letters, yeah? Yeah, okay. Kelev. Now, you know, of course, the vowels we're not going to be dealing with in a scroll in the Torah. It's written without the vowels. The consonants, the letters as they're written, and then how they're vocalized can vary. That's part of the oral tradition. Kelev, if you break it apart, it's ka-lev, like a heart, which is what a dog illustrates. The fact that a dog, as a domesticated animal, so to speak, illustrates the heart of its master. The dog goes after the heart of its master. We see a little bit of the essence of the meaning within the name of the word itself. And again, when Adam named all the animals, he named them with this in mind. Let's go a little further. By looking at breaking apart a name and turning and trying to read the word of what it means, we can see something about it. What's the word for the earth?
Adamah
is dirt. Eretz. Eretz is land, right? The world is called Eretz. Eretz. If we break that apart, rots. Rots means to run. Eretz means I run. I move. The name for the world itself illustrates that the world moves. And as we know, of course, it is running around in its orbit. There's another word for the world. Olam. Olam is from the root meaning elem, hidden. Another way to describe the world, physically aratz, that I run, it moves, but elem on a deeper, more spiritual level, the world is hidden. The world means a place where, so to speak, God's presence is hidden. And therefore, that gives us the option for free will. If you know that God is right there, right there. Okay, try it, right? It's like the boss is it. Hi there, you know, is it? Forget it. There's no free will. There's nothing going on. Only in a place where God's presence is hidden that we have the option. Maybe he's there, maybe he's not there. We can see it, not see it, etc. Now we have free will. Now we have the option where I can come in and make decisions. Otherwise, if you know that he's right, there's nothing going on. Olam, hidden, is one of the meanings of the word for the world. We're analyzing words right now by their definitions, by breaking it into reading it with different vocalizations, the same letters. Another way to analyze words, the Hebrew language, would be through the actual meaning of the letters. Now we can get the chair. Kisei. Kisei is chaf. What's a kaf? It means like in terms of the definition, but the word for the letter itself, kaf. A kaf is a hand, a palm specifically. Samech is the name of that letter. Somech is to support. Samecha no flim, he supports the fallen. So an aleph refers to above and below. What a chair does is it's a hand, a kaf, that supports from above to below, so to speak. What we're seeing now is the actual definition of the word, what the word does, what the object is intrinsic within the letters of the name. A kisei is exactly that. A little different than chair. Let's take another word, and we can break it apart into some of the things that you may already know. Let's take a word like... Midaber. That's a mem, believe it or not. Midaber. What does midaber mean? To speak. Let's break apart the words, the letters. Mem. A mem in front means from. Good. What's a dalet? A delet? A door. Base means house. Or actually, when it appears in front of a word, it means in. Which, by the way, that's the same concept. The fact that base is a house, means in. A house is has that concept involved. Right? And resh, what's a rosh?
Head.
If we schematically look at the letters of midaber, to speak, from the door in the head. Which is exactly what speaking's all about. It takes an idea in the head and brings it out into the world. That's what speaking, that's what speech is all about. Right? It's a wild language. It's a try it out with English sometimes. It just doesn't work.
Can you ask a question?
Yeah.
Is it fair necessarily to compare it to English, being that English is... I mean, where did speaking come from? Is that the Latin or the German or wherever else? If you look at the original word, it would be any different than that. In other words, you know, English being derivative, is it fair to say that because you can't break up chair, that it didn't, I mean, maybe in the Latin, good? I don't know.
Okay, that's a good question. Why are we looking at English? Why don't we talk about the old Latin? Why don't we talk about old Germanic languages? Huh? Well, I'm using English simply because we speak English. The question really is, perhaps you could go back to any language and find this type of a thing. All I can say about that is, try it. I mean, I did some linguistic studies and I have not found anything like this whatsoever. Yeah.
Isn't it true that a lot of the words were just made up on the spot when the language was being created?
Which language are you speaking to?
Hebrew, the everyday common usage of Hebrew.
That's one of my points, is that everyday commonly used Hebrew, which we mentioned earlier, is not Lashon HaKodesh, is not the holy tongue, the tongue of the Bible. What we're analyzing is Lashon HaKodesh, the fact that that language was taken, used as a popular language, and once it comes out into popular usage, it now becomes like any other language, which grows and changes and absorbs other words, etc. Fine, no problem with that. But Lashon HaKodesh, let's go back and analyze that. And any other language that you take, I have never seen anything whatsoever that's like this. Check it out. Talk to linguistics people.
When you said like this, are you saying when each individual letter actually means a word? Or like, instead of saying thought or speech in English, you're saying from the door in the head, when you break it down, each letter means, each character means an actual word.
We're really just getting rolling. You know at this point that every word in Hebrew has really a three-letter root, right? That three-letter root represents a concept. Now, depending on the prefix, the suffix, the grammatical construct that occurs around that three-letter root, it can become a noun, a verb, an adjective. It can become past, future, possessive, etc., all revolving around that root. What I'm presenting to you right now is that that three-letter root is not a symbol that means something. It describes the essence of what the word is all about. And it can give us insights into it. And we'll get to some further insights, God willing, shortly. Yes?
Is it possible that these letters were chosen to make up, to be used in these words because of their meaning? What I'm trying to say is that these letters were given meaning before the words were, and that's why they were chosen.
Well, the concept in Kabbalah is these letters had meaning. These letters had definite meaning well before language existed. I don't want to get too far into this, but in terms of these are called the letters of creation, so to speak, and these are the building blocks that describe the essence of the universe that we're in. So now the words, where do these words come from, etc., we have a tradition that this is it goes all the way back. It's a divine thing, basically. But I want to hold off on that point. Let's just look at that as an interesting statement, and let's just take a look at the language itself for the time being, and let's see where that's going. It just added into the total equation, the total picture. One aspect. I'm not trying to say, look, you see this language, God exists, right? I'm not saying that. Just put it into the total picture, that's all. This is the way that we, in learning Torah, look at the language, at the letters that we're studying. Yeah. Yeah, the truth is, it is a little naive to look at things in a simplistic fashion. We can't get too heavily into this. In Kabbalah, there are 10 levels to everything. There's 10 sfirot, whatever, I don't know. Maybe some of you have seen some things in terms of Kabbalah or whatever. I just want to digress briefly into what's Kabbalah. Kabbalah is often described as Jewish mysticism. I find that a little disturbing. I have yet to find a good definition for mysticism, and maybe if you guys have a definition, you can help me out. Huh?
Let's break it down.
Mysticism? Okay. Great. Mysticism, mystical, mystic, whatever. All these things deal with the supernatural, which is also beyond nature. All right, it could be. But Kabbalah, literally the word comes from the word lekabel, to receive. Kabbalah means a tradition, a received tradition passed on, passed on, passed on. The best definition for Kabbalah is Jewish physics. Physics describes how does the world work? What are the forces working between various things? How do they interact? What happens at the interface? You can get down into superficial levels of, let's say, Newtonian physics. You get down into Einsteinian physics, and it gets heavier. And you get into subatomic physics. You're really describing the essence of how does the world operate, the relationships between things, etc. That's exactly what Kabbalah is. What are the rules governing how does the world work? In fact, it reads just like a physics book. There are popular physics books out, First 3 Minutes, In Search of Schrodinger's Cat, you know, this kind of stuff. And you read it, and great, hey, all right, now I know quantum mechanics. You know, it's like, well, what it does is it gives you a good idea of what's happening and puts it into a language so we have an understanding. But if you really want quantum mechanics, you're going to have to start with calculus. Right? And that usually knocks most people out the door because you open up a real physics book and, hey, there's just all kinds of symbols going on. There's all kinds of formulas. And what is this stuff, right? And, you know, back to the drawing board. But if you really want to get physics and understand a little bit of the essence of our world, you need a much more in-depth study. Kabbalah also, there's popular Kabbalah books out. Unfortunately, an awful lot of them misrepresent the situation, and a lot of them are wrong. A lot of them are written by people who simply just have never studied it. They've got read a few popular books or whatever. I don't want to get too far into that. But real Kabbalah is Jewish physics. It deals with what are the forces at work. And instead of being, how does our physical world operate, Kabbalah would deal with how does the physical world interact with the spiritual universe? How does a non-physical God create a physical universe? How is a non-physical soul connected and interacting with a physical body? How do they connect in the first place? What happens at death when they separate, etc.? That's basically what Kabbalah is all about. And there are rules to the thing. There are formulas, so to speak. And if you open up a real Kabbalah book and you start reading it, it's symbols and it's formulas describing how things operate. Now, the more we can learn about something and get into it, the better we can understand it and use things. Anyone see or read Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court?
Yeah.
Right? Fancy the Bing Crosby version? Or So, you know, very interesting. The guy is suddenly transplanted from Connecticut into King Arthur's England. And he lights a match and, oh, whoa, look at that. This guy's unbelievable. What can he do? Now, we know you get a little phosphorus and sulfur and stuff together and, you know, you strike a match and it burns. It's very simple laws of physics and chemistry. But if you have no idea what's flying and you see this, wow, this guy's unbelievable, he's a magician. It's simply a manipulation of the things that exist in the world. Kabbalah is divided into theoretical Kabbalah, let's understand the world, and something that's called practical Kabbalah, which really we don't do or use at all. Practical Kabbalah, you may have heard things in the past about this, that, or the other thing, and it's really not used. However, what it means is by thoroughly understanding the world and how it operates, a person can attempt to work with it. All right. In Kabbalah, there are 10 sfirot. The 10 sfirot, it's all God going on. No one should think there's anything besides God. And the 10 sfirot, the best way to describe them is the way the Zohar describes it, as a lamp with different lenses on different faces. Each lens will give a different color. And it looks like many different colors of light. But in reality, it's all one light. It's one source. It's all coming from God. The 10 sfirot describe, let's say, different relationships going on. And these different relationships give us a way of working with the Almighty, a way of working in the world, a way of understanding things. There are 10 basic relationships. Those are those 10 sfirot. And those 10 basic relationships, why am I getting into all of this? Each letter has 10 levels also. So this is really an answer to your question, right? On one sense, it is a simplification just to say this letter means this. The letter ayin, and ayin is an eye. An ayan is a wellspring, a fountain. Each letter has 10 different levels going on. So in order to really analyze words, what we have to do is realize, find out what level we're dealing with, etc. It can be a little complicated. It's done. There are books and books and books that deal with this. All that we're trying to do right now is get a relatively simplistic approach so that we can understand a little bit about how the whole system operates. Realize we are dealing with, we're trying to keep a simple Hebrew vocabulary, and we're just trying to get a picture to realize this type of thing is there. Yeah. Okay, what about the visual level of the letters? That also is extremely significant. These are different ways to analyze a letter. One is the meaning. M means from. Another is the name of the letter itself describes the essence of it. Another is the structure of the letter describes something going on. Let's take, for example, the word for truth, emet. Emet, the word for false, sheker, false, lie. There's a verse in Psalms that says, Sheker en lo raglayim. Lies have no feet to stand on. If you look at the structure of the letters, Aleph has two solid feet, Mem has a base, and Tav has two solid feet. It stands securely. Sheker, the word for lie, Shin rests on one point, Kuf rests on one point, and Resh rests on one point. They're all off balance. You give it one shove and it falls apart. That's what a lie is. It's not really solid. It might look pretty good over there, but it's not really solid. Yeah?
Things like this, like the visual aspect, only work with bold print, right? Like it's printed on the
toilet. Correct. That's the script is merely a convenience to the best of my knowledge. But what we're talking about is the letters as they are written in a Torah scroll. Now let's just look a little bit further at this example. MS, truth. Aleph is the first letter. Mem is exactly in the middle of the alphabet. And Tav is the last letter. Truth spans the entire spectrum of what's going on. It covers all bases. Sheker are three letters all the way at the end. It's totally lopsided. It's a completely one-sided way of looking at things. That's what a lie is. All right? The center of Sheker, the kuf, a kuf in Hebrew is a monkey, an ape. A kuf, a monkey, superficially, it looks like a person. It'll do actions like a, Coco, right? It'll do things and look superficially like a person. But upon closer analysis, it's merely an imitation of human action. It really is not the true thing. Kuf. Look a little closer at the structure of the letter. The letter He, which is one of the letters in God's name. We'll talk about God's names shortly. The letter He is a letter indicating, in one sense, divinity. It's a letter from God's name. Kuf takes the He and extends it down below the line. It's a falsification of what the He is. We'll talk a little bit about the positioning of the letters, etc. It's really builds a little bit. So you asked a little bit about the structure of how the letters are. Hopefully this helps to illustrate. We have the name of the letter, the meaning of the letter as it would appear in the language. We have the structure of the letter. We also have the position of where the letter appears. We have how the letter relates in the Aleph base in connection to the others. There's a whole section in the Talmud which deals with the Aleph base. Aleph base, Aleph, Olef, it's the same root as Ulpan. You're familiar with the word as Ulpan. It means to learn. Aleph base, Olef Bina, to learn understanding. Gimel Dalet, Gomel Dalim, giving to the poor, etc. And there's all sorts of meanings that come out of the alphabet and the way that it's put together. Gomel Dalim is giving to the poor. If you take a look at the structure of the letter, a gimel and a dalet. The gimel, to give, gomel is to bestow, and the dal is a poor person. The gimel has its little foot out and it's running after the dalet, right? The dalet faces away, but you see the little thing in the back, the little hand is out to receive. This tells us one of the ways to give charity. A person should run after the poor person. Don't wait for him to come to me. Somebody needs help, I should run to him. And you don't face him right on. That can be embarrassing. the best way to give to somebody, if they're running away and they don't want to take, hey, you try to give to them anyway, but, you know, give it in the back door. Don't give it in a way that will embarrass the person. There are tremendous, wonderful ethical lessons that can come out of this through the study of the letters. Names. We mentioned God and his names. Where is this stuff coming from? I would like to talk about this fellow over here, John Smith. His name is John Smith. His friends, though, call him Johnny. His golfing partners call him Smitty. His mother calls him Jonathan, right? His patients call him Doctor. His wife calls him Dear. His kids call him Dad. His father calls him Son. He has many names, and each name represents the relationship going on. So too all the names of God. Each name of God that's used represents the relationship that's going on.
Do we know from the Bible how many names there are for God yet?
I don't know. There are 10 basic names. We mentioned there are 10 spheres. There are 10 basic names. And then there are other names dealing with other levels and other types of relationships. 72 three-letter names, etc. There's a lot of names because there's a lot of ways to relate to God. Right? So, yeah.
How about the name of God, like the 22 letters that nobody knows? Supposedly built the golden calf.
Well, there are a lot of names. Let's just leave it at that. Yeah, there's a lot of names out there. By the way, 22 letters. How many letters are in the alphabet? 22. There's a 42-letter name that comes out of the first two sentences in the Torah. There's a lot of names, and most of them are involved somewhere along the line in the Torah, permutations, etc. This is one of the things that's going on in the prayer, etc., when people will say stuff in Hebrew, and the verses from the Torah, from the Psalms, etc., that make up part of the prayers, a lot of these involve names of gods and building on relationships. And, you know, some of us may not even be aware that they're there, but it's pretty jam-packed. Let's try to get a little deeper into things. Let's take a look at the word for a human being, Adam. Adam, you know, we have the story of Adam and Eve. I think personally it's has a big problem in terms of the way that we grew up and saw this whole story. Face it, we basically, I don't know about everyone here, but most of us grew up, I'm sure, in a Christian society. We're colored with the viewpoints that we have heard as children. And this is a big problem at all in dealing with the Bible. Most of us heard them as children's stories. And now we look at them and we're adults looking at children's stories. To open up all over again and look at them through the eyes of an adult and analyze them as adult stories can reveal all kinds of things going on. One thing that I have found in dealing with people, Catholics, etc., their impression of the creation story is God created man, the masculine of the species. It's not good for man to be alone, so he makes a helpmeet, you know, a little something or other, a servant to help him out, take care of him, and do whatever he wants. And then you have man and woman. Fine. Takes a rib, separates out, makes a little servant, take care of this guy. And onwards. That viewpoint, I'm sure, is where the whole Catholic macho world viewpoint comes from, and we know what sort of a society that builds. The Torah point of view is so different, it's awesome. Adam refers to human being. Adam is a person. It does not mean male. It does not mean female. Adam. It says, male and female, God created Adam. That's one being. Adam, analyzing the letters. An Aleph you can see, is a yud above and a yud below. Yud above and yud below, a spiritual and physical connection. And this is the essence, the epitome of what a human being is. A connection between the spiritual and physical. We have a physical body. We have a spiritual soul. And by just keeping this one thing in mind, it can open up all sorts of wonderful clarity to us. The spiritual, the soul, the physical, the body. The body being physical craves physical. Feed me. Give me more, right? The body loves physical. From the dust of the earth, so to speak, and since it's created from physical matter, it wants to just lay around like dust. Right? And try getting out of bed sometime after a heavy night, right? It's tough. It's tough. That's the body talking. On the other hand, the soul, the spiritual, craves spiritual enlightenment. I want to know. I would really like to get close to God and touch these incredible realms, etc. Now, that right there is the dichotomy of what a human being's all about. The body is physical, it wants physical. The soul is spiritual, it wants spiritual. And this body, soul, spiritual, physical pull, which way am I going to go, is what free will is all about. What am I going to choose, a body or a soul? Mind you, this is a beautiful, wonderful system. It gives me the opportunity for choice. If I'm just a body, like an animal, let's say, which has a level of soul, but not to the extent of a human being. Everything, by the way, has a level of soul. Rocks, plants, animals, everything. But a rock isn't too spiritual. But an animal is so body-oriented, it doesn't really have free will. It goes for its body. You know, it might choose, do I want to eat that or this? You know, there's food over here and there's a female over there, and you know, which way is it going to go? But it's physical that it deals with. There are spiritual essences, so to speak, and there's nothing to talk about. It's just spiritual. But a human being both, being body and soul, wow, now we can choose. We can go in either direction. And if you ever have a choice to make, a very simple way to at least get clarity is, who's talking? Is it my body or is it my soul? I have heard many a time over here, well, these classes are very interesting. I'd like to stay and hear more. But, you know, I kind of like to go down to a lot to the beach. Now, who's talking? You tell me. Who wants to learn more? Soul. Who wants to go and hang out on the beach? Body. Clarity, that's all. It's a tool. The soul is good. The body is good. They're both beautiful and wonderful. And like a horse and rider, where if the horse just wanders around, it can be useless if not destructive. And if the soul, the rider, so to speak, wants to go in a certain way without the body, without the horse, nothing's going to happen. That's the body and soul. And a horse and rider working together can accomplish fantastic things. It can cover ground and get to places that either one alone could never get to. That's what we strive for, to harmonize soul and body, that it should both work together. Because this Aleph, which is one above, a yud above and a yud below, Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet. The numerical value of Aleph is 1. And that's what we strive to do, harmony, to unite ourselves. These are lessons within the letters that we can apply to ourselves. Yeah?
Is there any significance to, like, Adam also being red with the blood?
Ah, that's exactly it. That's perfect. That's what our tradition tells us. What it is, a human being is a soul and a body linked through the dam, and dam is blood. The blood is, so to speak, looked at as let's call it the interface between soul and body, and how exactly it works, etc., is certainly not for right now. But, and you know that there are so many things involved in blood in the Torah because of this exact connection going on. Just one slight moment. There's a problem with eating blood, and that's part of what koshering meat and shechita, etc., is all about. That's part of what the koshering process, to get the blood out. We know that there's the menstrual blood, which is dealt with extensively in the Torah. Blood is a quite significant aspect. In the offerings, blood was part of the thing, and that we should talk about at some point too, because we have Christian attitudes of sacrifices, buying off an angry God. If there's enough blood and guts around, then that'll distract God from thee. That's not at all what the offerings were about. The word in Hebrew for offering, korban, comes from the root lekarev, to come close. It was a way of coming close to God. And if you want to eat a steak, you have to shecht the animal and get the blood out, etc. So too, in the temple, most of the offerings were eaten. And if you want to eat an animal, you have to shecht it. However, in the temple, we're dealing with a higher level of focus. I'm just really giving this very briefly. Some of the blood is sprinkled on the altar. Sprinkling it on the altar, just a little bit, it focuses me. Now, there's more to mitzvahs than just focus, but part of it is the focus aspect. Sprinkling a little on the altar focuses me that, hey, I want to raise things to a higher level. Some of the fats are burnt on the altar. The fats are my desire system. I want to raise that to a higher level. And by the way, the animal, a person had to rest his weight on the animal's head. He had to check out that animal to make sure there's no blemishes. And he has to be standing there when that animal is shechted. Anybody ever eat meat here? Yeah. Anybody ever see an animal shechted? Shechita. A moving experience? Did it shake you up? Can you imagine if that was your animal? You had rested your weight on it. You had walked up and checked out that animal for 3 days before. That's your animal. And you're standing right there. And now, before it was little fluffy, and now it's dead meat. That shakes you up. Wow, life and death. What is it? Puts it in perspective. And that animal that you saw shechted right in front of you, you saw some of the blood sprinkled and the fats burned. You're now going to take that animal home. But hold on. What do I own in this world? What part of it goes to the Kohen? I take the rest of it home, and those lamb chops, I eat that. And I'm going to eat that in a state of consciousness, realizing this animal is becoming a part of me. Eating is a very religious experience. It can be done unconsciously, but to do it consciously, it can be an elevating experience. This animal is becoming a part of me. It's going from animal to human being. That's a fantastic thing. It's an incredibly spiritual experience. Just imagine eating an animal that you saw shechted before your very eyes. Wild, right? That's part of what the offerings are all about. And that's how it helps us to get as close to God, is by snapping us into total focus. It's a heavy experience. Yeah, so you mentioned blood. Yeah, you had a...
How does each good equal one equal the spiritual and one equal the physical world? I don't see. How did they come up with that a yud equals that?
We have a yud above and we have a yud below.
Right.
So to speak, the physical world. The world is above and below. Spiritual, physical connection. I mean, you can start analyzing this. We did not speak about gematrias yet, numerical values, but every letter has a numerical value. It's a base 10 system, and yud has a numerical value of 10. Yud, 10. You could look at this line in the middle as a vav. That's the way it's described. Vav is a line. Is 6. Put it all together, Aleph, which is a numerical value of 1. All together, if you add up the parts, it comes to 26. 26 is the numerical value of the name of God, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, all together.
How'd you get the 6?
This is a Vav down the line, this line in the middle. What if you split it apart? Right? You have, so to speak, 13 above and 13 below. You split the vav. Echad is 1, 8, 4. Altogether, that's 13.
But what's echad?
Echad means one. Unity. We look at God down below, so to speak. God is one. Up above, God is one. God is, that's part of what the Shema is all about. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Wherever you look, whatever aspect we're looking at, it's all one God going on. Etc. I don't want to get too far into these things because, you know, you may start, oh, you're reading stuff into this. Anybody could make this up, whatever. I'm not trying to say, look, isn't this awesome that this exists and therefore it proves that God exists. I'm not trying to say that at all. Might be true, but you can come to that conclusion. You don't need me for that. What I want to tell you is we look at letters this way.
When we're dealing with a text, when we open up the Torah and read it, and we're dealing with letters, this is part of the message that we look for, that we try to understand. This is part of what learning Torah is all about. There's levels and levels and levels and levels and levels. And I'll tell you, Shakespeare may be great, but you know how far you can go to analyze thy. Okay, let's take a slightly further look. We mentioned that every letter, every word, consists of a three-letter root. And we talked a little bit about the structure of a letter. The letter, pardon my art, the letter pe. Pe, what's a pe? Mouth. An opening, so to speak. The black space of the letter is critically important, but the Torah is described as black fire on white fire. The white space is also important. If you look at the white space of the letter pe, within the letter, you'll see another letter.
A base.
Base means in the house, the inside. A pe, an opening, a mouth, brings you to the inside. On one sense, the essence of what the letter pe is all about is it's an opening to the inside. Now, let's take a look at the letter Resh. Resh, a Rosh is a head. A head is closure. Just bear this in mind. Take this right now as the concept of closure. We talk about a head of garlic, right? A head of lettuce. We're talking about a closed unit. That level of head, the head of a nail, etc. Pei Resh will mean, on one sense, opening of something that was closed. The opening of something that was closed. And each word that has three letters as part of the root, this final third letter now will modify the concept. And I'd just like to run through the dictionary all the words that start with Pei Resh, and let's take a look and see if this really illustrates the concept at all. See if you can find the opening of something that was closed concept within the words. Pei Resh Aleph Para means to run wild, to go crazy. Bursting out. Right? You can see the concept in there. Peresh Dalet Parad, Pered, means to separate. Specifically, you know, they talk about if you have a lulav, a branch, and leaves are opening up and falling out, that's called Pered. Separation of something that was closed, an opening of something that was closed. Peresh Ha, Hey, Parad, means to be fruitful, to bear fruit. You had one unit, now it's expanding to become many units. Peresh Zion, Paraz, Prazim are unwalled cities. A walled city, hit the wall and that's it. But unwalled cities expand and keep bursting forth. That's the concept. This expansion concept. Peresh Hey, Parach, Parach means to flower, to blossom. The closed bud opens up into the fully revealed flower, an opening of something that was closed. Peresh Tes Parat means, if you go into a store and you have a 10-shekel note and you want change, Efshar Lifrot. Lifrot Parat means to break down into units. You take a hole and break it into units. This opening of something that was closed. A Prat, as a noun, means a specific detail. Paras means to slice. Take a loaf of bread, slice it up. You had one unit, and you've broken it into many. This is that same concept. Let's just run through it. Peiresh tzadi, paratz, means to break through a fence, to breach something, to cause an opening into something that was closed. Peiresh mem param means to unravel. You have a piece of cloth and you pull on it and param, it's unraveling. Closure, a unit, and you're opening it up. Peiresh shin, parosh, means to spread out. You had one thing and now you're spreading it out. The ultimate in this word is going to be when that third letter is the same as the second letter. It multiplies itself, so to speak. Peiresh resh parar means to crumble, to pulverize, to take something and just break it, not into slices, into crumbs. It's the ultimate of taking a unit and breaking into its parts, opening. Each word contains the essence, each letter contains a little bit of the essence of what the word is all about. It's possible. And again, each letter has 10 levels. It's hard to know exactly what we're doing, but we have books that tell us. But it's possible if you hit a word that you don't know, and it sounds like another word, you have some of the letters, you could take a guess. And you'd be amazed how often you'll come close. So in each case, the word resh is rosh, means head. We mentioned each letter does have 10 levels to it. Head, as we know head, in Midaber you see it quite clearly. In the resh, as I was explaining it, we went to a slightly expanded level of what head is, like a head of garlic, a head of lettuce, etc. A head also means the end point of something, the head of a rope, the end of a rope, etc. But these are all meanings inherent within the letter itself, within the meaning of the word. Again, I can't emphasize enough. I'm simply showing you this is a system that we use. This is a way of looking at the Hebrew language. When we're learning Torah, we can be involved in this type of thing. It's a legitimate way of learning Torah. I'm not saying, hey, look, here's a theory that this goes on, maybe it's real. You could do that also, and I'm sure it would work out. I'm just trying to illustrate that this is another way of looking at the letters.
The example you just used right now with the Parar and those three letters, that three letter structure, okay, that's from Lashon HaKodesh, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, does the same apply for the opposite of that, to bring it back together? Is there any such three letter kind of thing that, you know what I mean, like two letters and then you add a third one, like 10 different examples, put back together to reassemble?
I'll tell you, I'm sure there is, and I simply don't know it offhand. It could be. I know there is the word. Kesher means to tie a knot. The final letter there is the resh, which is the closure, which is a connection. Chibor means to connect, which ends in a resh. The final letter is that closure letter, etc. I'm just saying this off the top of my head, right? You know, I would suggest look in the dictionary and start playing around, you know, if you want to find some things. It's amazing. You can find a lot of stuff. All right, let's look a little more at the structure of letters. We talked about the position of how they appear. Within the space that the letters appear, in a scroll, in a mezuzah, in a Torah, there are lines etched into the parchment.
Sirtut, there are scratches made, and that is at the top of every line of writing. And all the letters appear within a particular space. I wrote in a bottom line for illustration, but the letters appear within a particular space. Some letters extend above the line. Some letters extend below the line. In Kabbalah, the space within the line is this world. Above the line is realms of higher spirituality, higher holiness, if you will. Below the line is realms of voy vavoy into the negative, if you will. Now, I wouldn't say that necessarily, but that needs some explanation, too, as to what's going on there. We can talk about that sometime. But it's down into the realms of the negative junk, etc. You can sometimes analyze things in that way. I heard this from a Rav who's a Mekubal, someone who deals with Kabbalah, and it was Hanukkah time, and he was explaining the word for the nation Greece. There were three sons that Noah had. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now let's analyze these three sons. Those are the names of these people. Great, that was their name. George and Fred, and yeah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Yeah. On the other hand, a name, as we now know, illustrates the essence of something. And names in the Bible, that's why you see all of these names going on, there can be tremendous stuff happening. These three names illustrate three directions in life, three approaches to what life is all about, three ways of trying to get close to God. Shame, what does shame mean? A name. It's the intellect. Through understanding, through names, through the, and on trying to understand the essence of things, that's their approach to try to get close to God. By the way, we are descended from Shem, people of the book, so to speak. Ham, hot, heat, the passions, the emotions, the feelings, to try to get close to God in that respect. It could work, but we know from the story they got messed up very quickly. Japheth, the root there is Yofi, which means beautiful, beauty. And that's also an approach to God. Beauty. You're standing there out at the coast with the waves crashing on the rocks and the sun setting, and it's like, it's awesome, you're uplifted. There's an immediate connection, this night sky with the desert stars, awesome. It can connect us quickly. Beauty is extremely powerful. The descendants, so-and-so is descended from so-and-so, etc. The main descendant from Japheth is Yavon, Greece. And the Greek culture is oriented so strongly around beauty. Even their intellectual pursuits were oriented towards beauty. Poetry, theater, art. That's the classic golden age of Pericles, right? The classic Greek culture as we know it is oriented towards that. Physical beauty, the physical form, beauty. A possibility to get close to God? Absolutely. So much so that the first letter that they have of their name, the Yud, is right up at the top of the line. It's not even connected to the bottom. Beauty is transcendental. They could have just jumped above the line into the higher realms and wow, spectacular. The progression of Greek culture, the next level is a Vav. A Vav. All right, they didn't get above the line, but, you know, they're still hanging in there. And finally, Yavon, Greece, the Nun, bzz, down below the line, into the depths and degradation that we know Greek culture ultimately descended into. And today, Greece is basically a has-been, a past in search of the future.
So the word Yavon described in Greece is actually in the Torah?
Yes. Yavon is one of the children of Yafes, and Yavon is the name for the nation Greece. It is in the Torah.
Prophetic.
Huh?
Saying like the culture was
going to
sort of go down.
That's absolutely correct. Torah is full of these prophecies. That is correct. If we have the eyes and know how to use them, it's awe-inspiring. In fact, the book of Daniel, which was written during the Babylonian exile, has such incredibly explicit references to Greek culture, Alexander the Great, the Ptolemaic times, etc. It's pretty scary, just the incredible accuracy going on. But you need the key to open it up to see it. The Book of Daniel, I highly recommend it. Yes?
What's the word for Rome?
Rome is... The word Rome is the city. The word, you can get into this, and Rome did not exist at the time, of course. Edom or Esav is who Rome is descended from. And you'll probably learn more about that later. I don't want to get too far sidetracked. It's... People can go wild with this stuff. And, you know, it's like if you just start breaking things apart and playing around with it. There are those who said that Russia, well, a Russia is a wicked person, and the Russian system was pretty rough. There it's America, Amreka, is rake means empty, an empty nation, right? It's a, what can I say, etc. People play around with these things. Interesting. Ways of analysis, but I prefer to stick with the texts as we have them and not try to play around and apply this to modern society too much. By the way, if you take a look at the Jewish people, Yisrael, and you analyze our name, we also have a Yud, the sin... is a right, left, and middle, all coming to one point. Balance, that's the key. The resh, the rosh, the head. We have to intellectualize things.
Because you used that Hebrew word live before, it was unbalanced.
That's right. It's very tricky. It's all on one point. It's all on one point. But it has three lines, a right, left, and a middle. That's correct. I knew the kuf that we used before. You have three letters in there, and they all modify each other. The kuf is the hey, but extends below the line. We now know a little more about what below the line means. This is all, this is the system, right? Resh is the head. We want to intellectualize things. The aleph. Is the connection of above to below, a spiritual and physical connection. Keep connected in that respect. And finally, the word, the letter Lamed, takes us above the line, ding, 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 daily double, into the realms of the higher spirituality. Notice that the word Lamed, what is Lomed? To learn. That's really the essential way to reach these higher levels. The Lamed extends above the line, because through learning, that is our key, that's our tool to reach these higher levels. By the way, again, you know, the concept of learning in a scroll, a lamed is written, it's a chaf and a vav. Chaf has a numerical value of 20, vav has a value of 6. Again, it's 26 God's name. That shows a little bit of the essence of what learning is all about. It's a way to connect to the ultimate. Hanukkah, when we have the primary conflict between the Greek culture and Israel. It was not a concept that they wanted to wipe out the Jewish people. If we assimilated and joined the Greeks, everything would have been fine and dandy. That's what they wanted. Come on down to the gymnasium for a wrestling match and a couple of beers with the boys, and everything's great. But we who wanted to stay and learn Torah, etc., they couldn't stand that. It was an ideological struggle. The Torah tells me there is something greater than man on this planet, and we are attempting to connect to it. What the Jewish people try to do is, so to speak, raise the level of human being to come as close to God as we possibly can. What the Greeks did is they lowered God to the level of human being. And you take a look at the Greek gods. I'm sure we're all familiar with mythology. They're all doing all kinds of junk. They're trying to lower God to the level of human being. And then it rationalizes anything that they do is just fine. We try to raise human being to the higher level. They hated that. Our very existence in terms of living with Torah was an anathema to them. They couldn't stand it because it's a slap in the face. It's telling them that, no, your system is not the greatest thing going on. They wanted to say the human being is the most perfect thing on the planet, and that's it. We're saying, no, we have to work on ourselves and raise ourselves to higher levels. It's a great starting point, but now that we have the material, so to speak, it's what you do with it, right? It's not an end point as already. It's what we do with our lives and our potential. That's the key. We try to raise ourselves. They tried to get rid of that. There are no coincidences going on. That's one of the key points of Torah thought. And every year during Hanukkah, we read the story of Joseph. When Joseph is sold down into Egypt. Joseph is called Yosef HaTzadik, the righteous one. What made him so righteous? So he's sold down into Egypt. His master, named Potiphar, had a wife known as Potiphar's wife. Now she really had it for Joseph. She was after him day and night, putting the moves on him. And here's this young guy down there in Egypt, and, you know, that's not the most moral, ethical places. Nobody knows him, and he keeps holding out. Sorry, lady, you got the wrong guy. But she keeps putting the pressure on more and more and more and more. Finally, one day, what happened? Everybody's out at some idol-worshipping festival. Joseph and Potiphar's wife are all alone at home, and she really puts on the steam. He almost fell, but in the end, he resisted. He held himself back. He held himself back, and he ran. He bolted. Because of that event, that's called one of the toughest tests anybody could survive, right? He came through it. He's called Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the righteous one. What makes a person righteous? The letter Tzadi. Tzadi means, as in the word Tzimtzum, Tzadik. Tzadi is a Tzadik. It's the ability to hold oneself back. That's what righteousness is. What the Greeks were saying, hey, go for it. If it feels good, do it. Just let yourself go. What the Jewish people were saying, no. There comes a time when you have to hold yourself back, and you don't just go for everything. That's what being righteous is all about, tzadi. What the Greeks tried to do is remove this tzadik nature from the Jewish people. The Jewish people have many names also, which illustrate various relationships. One of us, you've heard of Zionism, right? Zion. Zion, Zion, the word goes all the way back to King David, and I'm sure even before that. Zion is the Jewish people. It's a watchword for us. What is the essence of this? What relationship is illustrated by Zion? The Greeks wanted to remove the righteous nature of the Jewish people, the Tzadi. What happens when you take the Tzadi out of Zion? What's left? Yavon, Greece. If you take this ability to hold back out of a Jew, there's nothing left than a libertine Greek. What are we going to do? The Jew has incredible potential, and boy, when we fall hard. And unfortunately, a Jew that falls apart can be one of the worst things going on in the world. But if we hold ourselves together, we can want to be one of the great things. As in all things, potential is a balance. The potential for the greatest has also the potential for the worst. The two greatest challenges, greatest pleasures in the world, food and sex, have the greatest potential for abuse. It's a double-edged sword. We have fantastic potential. If we use it, if we come through with it, tremendous. I just want to, in closing, want to show you one more example of this. Because we're telling you the Torah, every letter, every word has meaning. It's fantastic, spectacular stuff. All right, great, let's check it out. You open up the Bible, and what does it say? Well, so-and-so begat so-and-so and lived so long and begat so-and-so and he begat so-and-so and, hey, this is great, you know, begat so-and-so. Come on, what's going on here? Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who lived in the 1800s, was fighting this exact concept where people were saying, this book is out of date. It has no meaning anymore. And they'd point to things like this and say, what do you need this for? And he was telling them, well, you've got to be kidding. Every single word has incredible meaning running through it. And he wrote a commentary on the Torah that explains things fantastically, deeper levels, the words especially in the letters he deals with. He takes those generations, Adam, on through, and explains what they mean. And I'd like to go through a little bit of this with you. Seven generations. Let's take a look. Adam is human being. We went into that already. It opens up a section in the Bible, says, I don't see one around, but it says, this is the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Adam. All right, it's English, but we'll get by. That's okay, it's all right, don't. These are the generations of Adam. We can read that as Adam and Eve. And by the way, we didn't talk yet about man, woman, etc., and how you see what happens with the words. Just one brief thing, you may have heard this or seen this or whatever. Ish is a human being, is a man. Isha is a woman. Mind you, we have the concepts of both the aleph, which is standing securely, and the shin, which is potentially off balance. We have to connect and be grounded. And if you take a look, within the word for man is a yud. Within the letter for the word letters for woman, isha, is a hey. Yud and hey is one of the names of God. When a man and woman are together, husband and wife, and they have God's name dwelling between them, that is a fantastic relationship. Each person has to see the godliness in the other person. What if they don't? What if they just look at the other person as a thing? They remove the godliness from that person? That's terrible. And if you take the yud out of ish, you take the hay out of isha, all that you have left is ish and ish, fire. And baby, look out. These are the generations of Adam. I see somebody penciled this in, Nate. Good. This is the book of the Chronicles of Adam. The first after him, his child is Seth, Chase. It's in Hebrew. I'm just going to write them, but Seth. Shes means standing strongly, secure, firm. Evan Shasia, the foundation stone. He knew who he was. He knew his relationship with God. He knew what he was trying to accomplish in the world. He was clear on his goals. What a person. Fantastic. I still keep going. Yeah, I know. This is the end. Shes. The next generation after him, his child is Enosh. Enosh, Enoshim are people. Not the high level of a chase, so strong and secure, but still a person, everything's fine and dandy, fantastic, great. The next generation after him is Kenan. If the parents aren't so strong, the next generation you get is Kenan. Kenan is Kenyan, acquisition, liknot, to buy. Hey, look, we're physical beings in a physical world. You got to use the physical world, etc. And they get into buying, and it's great, fantastic. The world is here to use. What are the kids going to see? What's the most important thing going on? Buying. It's not who you are, it's what you have, right? What kind of car you got? How thick is the pile in your carpeting? The next generation is Mahalalel. Mahalalel means to praise God. Sounds great. But that's their description of who they are. That's all they do. Lip service. Yeah, they go to shul. They still daven. They still go to, they belong to a temple. But that's all they do. Lip service. They just go through the motions. The heart isn't there. When their kids see that, this is hypocrisy. Forget it. Who needs that? And then the next generation is Yered. Yered means to go down into the pits. When their kids see that it's just hypocrisy and lip service, forget it. Who needs this? I'm not going there. Forget it. Into the pits, into the mud, into whatever they can sink into. Unbelievable. The next generation after that? Henoch. Henoch, chinuch means education. They start looking, if this is what the parents are into, there's no meaning, there's nothing going on in life, there must be more to life than this. And they start seeking, they start looking, they start trying to find meaning, what is going on? Education, looking for reality and truth. And boy, when people look for reality and truth, it is so great. It says Henoch walked with God. That is such an incredible level. What are those kids going to see? Their children. Truth seeking is the way to go. Looking for reality, that their kids, the next generation is Methuselah. Methuselah, which Rev Hirsch says is the letters like Mavos Shalach. Death can be sent away. They can reach eternity. They can fix the whole world. This is the book of the generations of Adam. This is the pattern. Now, this was written in the 1800s by Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. He gave us this explanation. It is so relevant today. It's unbelievable. It's incredible. Because this is the pattern of human behavior. That's what I was talking about. This is from that section, so-and-so begat so-and-so, right? Meaning, it's in there. If you get into the letters, you get into the words, it opens up. It's a whole new book going on. I wish you great success in your endeavors. Keep looking. Keep seeking. Go for the gold.
Thank you for listening to ClassicSinai.com. We hope that you have enjoyed this class. For other free classes, just return to ClassicSinai.com. If you feel that your friends and family would appreciate this class, click on our easy Send to a Friend link. Shalom from the Western Wall.